You start out with the macrocosmos, and end up with a single human life 1900 years ago. Well, it's like, what was it, Gladstone asked Faraday what was the value of a storage battery, and Faraday replied to Gladstone, what's the possible use of a newborn baby? You're referring to St. Elliot over here?
St. Elliot.
Bill, why don't you emphasize everybody else? I would like for you to give us a dissertation on mind. Is it material, spiritual, or are there different phases of it? And I know you talked about mind 50 times, but we've talked about it 50 times too. And there's been some discussions that I think would, no one takes anyone's word for anything. In our group, we say this when you come down.
I want to correct her. We always catch one when she says.
Are we under any obligation when we get to the right
thing? Yeah.
She's learned that trick, hasn't she?
I want to tell you, I think life would become unbearable for birth between you and George and Clyde now, three of you, isn't there?
Yeah, that used to be Clyde's name.
I hope you're getting my corner.
Within the next 35 minutes, sir, I must leave at 4 o'clock.
We'll try and button this up in 35 minutes. First of all, Mac, let me warn you. The only difference between me and these other folks is my ignorance is better unified than theirs is about what this book teaches me. First of all, let's get mind in perspective. It's one of four realities, the four realities, three of which exist in quality and quantity, and the fourth, I think we wouldn't be too far off if we thought of it as a qualitative reality. Matter, mind, and spirit are different in quality of reality, and they also may vary, any of them, in quantity of reality. You can measure the gravity action of spirit gravity on spiritual mass, or physical gravity on physical mass, or apparently mind gravity on the mass of mind. Personality gravity, however, can not be measured from a quantitative standpoint, only qualitatively. There are four realities. Mind can be material, spiritual, or pure mind. Neither material nor spiritual. And then there is something which is ancestral to mind. God the Father, like God the Son, has no mind, because both are antecedent to God the Spirit, who is the source of mind. But God the Father and God the Son think, plan, contrive, project, and the papers use the term mindedness to describe wherewith they think. They are not thinking with mind, but they are thinking with that which is ancestral to mind. Or to put it otherwise, the papers say that a spirit spirit being does not have to be endowed with mind, because spirit is innately conscious. That spirit being may be endowed with mind, but spirit without mind is not unconscious. Good example, the thought adjuster, a fragment of the Father, completely outside the mind circuit. Reflectivity won't penetrate it. It'll register its presence, but it can't register the content of the mindedness of the adjuster. But this adjuster plans, projects, adjusts, has all the apparent attributes of consciousness and thinking, but does not have mind. It has a mindedness, which, like the Father's consciousness, is ancestral to mind. We can feel mind. We think with it. It's not our body. That's material, isn't it? And yet mind is not spirit. Mind can be monstrous. Hitler had a mind. And he planned. And he contrived. Rather nefariously. Mind always tends to dominate matter. The universe is mind planned, mind made, and mind supervised, with the exception of paradise. Because, starting with Havona, what agency created Havona? Conjoint actor. What's the agency through which the Father Son operated? And ever since then, the physical universe is being run by the indirect creatures of the third source and center. Power centers, power supervisors, master physical controllers, and so on. A physical being has to have mind to be conscious. A spiritual being does not. Mind per se is capable of being moral without necessarily being spiritual. There are personal creatures who are material beings who have mind, but no spirit endowment. These would be moral beings. We don't know who they are, but we merely know that there are such beings. A spiritual being can be a person with or without mind. A personalized thought adjuster has no mind, and yet is a bona fide personality. And more. But there seems to be one limitation of mind. There are no beings of pure mind. And if there are no beings of pure mind, there are no personalities of pure mind. Mind is never found alone in a living being. I was surprised to read that, but that statement is made twice in these papers. There are beings who are principally mind and not too much spirit. The reflective group, I think, would fall in that category. But they're not without spiritual nature. But the papers tell us there are other examples that are much better that are unknown to us, where a being is principally a minded being and incidentally a spiritual being. And I think there are other beings who are principally spiritual, and incidentally, they're endowed with mind. Mind can be material. The kind of mind that we use, we're instructed, is material mind. linear gravity responsive mind. Now, I don't think we have mind in the sense of having so many grams of mind, so many ounces of mind. But I think if we had instruments that were subtle enough, we could measure the departure of mind from a dying body. But I don't think the mass of mind is enough to permit us to measure it. Yes.
Isn't mass one prerequisite of a material that it has mass?
Does electricity have mass?
Electrons.
Does electricity have mass? Does heat have mass?
You're going to need their mind?
No. I'm merely saying that there are physical phenomena. I'm not sure about this. I think mind does have mass, but I think it's very attenuated mass. I think it's linear gravity responsive. No, I'm talking about human mind. We have what they call material mind. This is not the cosmic mind.
That's an adjective.
Yes.
But what attributes of material?
I don't know.
Does this mind in this hand?
I think it's linear gravity responsive, which means that there's mass of some kind in there.
You said you cannot measure it in grams or milligrams.
I think it could be measured. I think it could be measured if our measurements were fine enough. This must be true if I read this blue book correctly. But I think the mass of mind is so subtle that it eludes our crude measurements.
Where do you find out the true mass of mind?
I never
knew
mass of mind. Mass of mind having mass before.
I've been utterly shocked.
I don't know. Well, stand by for
the Uranta group one night.
Stand by for a ram.
This one thing.
The roof went off.
No.
Mind is material.
I'll find you that statement. Let me see. Where are we now?
Mind is material.
I've been doing a little homework.
I didn't retain it.
Burke warned me that there was going to be a discussion of mine, so I did a little homework beforehand.
Well, I think he's just one tenth better than he is when he's normal.
Page 480. Section 10. Universal non-spiritual energy systems. Material mind systems. That word material means what it says.
Doesn't that mean mind systems are material beings?
Nope. I don't think so. Now, they list three kinds of material mind: pre-adjutant spirit minds, adjutant spirit minds, and evolving Marantia minds. And Marantia, by definition, is a mix of matter and spirit. On the next page, they say, linear gravity response is a quantitative measure of non-spirit energy. Yeah. Now they use mind in another sense, spirit mind, in contrast to material mind. And you notice they don't inventory the cosmic mind by number in here. They merely go on in the discussion of mind, talking about the cosmic mind and then mind on beyond Marantia mind. I think mind, Clyde, operates on three levels of manifestation. Material, pure, and spiritual. Mind, which is a quasi-material circuit. Mind, which is a quasi-spiritual circuit. And mind, which falls in neither category, pure mind, and which follows no material or spiritual law, but is a law unto itself in the universe.
Well, that's pure.
That's pure mind.
Well, now, is that free mind?
No. That's mind.
Uh-huh.
Material mind, and spirit mind.
Mm-hmm.
To spell it out very clearly.
Well, let's call those green minds, blue minds, and white minds as the adjective before the noun.
Yeah.
And I cannot see why we have to attribute mass to any of them.
Well, I have a feeling.
Material aspect.
I deduce that human mind is linear gravity responsive.
What gives you that feeling?
Because it's material mind, in contrast to spirit mind.
No, it is the mind of the material being as in contrast to the mind of a spirit being. Can it not be inferred that would be the
qualification? Yeah, you could make that inference. I don't share it.
That's the inference I always make.
Yeah. I would like to make the inference because the one I make is, it gets me into a lot more hot water. But I'm driven
sure
to it.
Sure as hell does.
Yeah,
you
I'm driven
no
to
idea.
It.
You better believe it. The one you make gets you in hotter water.
That's right. The,
Well, I was ready to burn Burke for a heretic one night.
Well, move over. Oh, yeah. Their fag is enough for both of us.
One faggot will do the job of just.
We almost broke up the
Uranium meeting. I won't quarrel with your interpretation, Clyde. I merely say I don't share it.
I'd like an honorable approach.
Yeah, now I'd like to share it because it would simplify things a great deal.
I've got to have a simple bill.
Yeah.
And I can't put a gram measurement with an instrument that hasn't been invented yet to the mind circuit working in your head.
I think that mind, until you get beyond the Marantia level, I think you're involved with matter in some way, shape, or form.
You think it works all matter and
well, here now. What is neuricity? Neuricity is the quasi-electrical current that flows over the neural network of the human body. And the best simple definition I know of it is it's slow-moving electricity. It acts much like electricity, but does not have the velocity of electricity. It's comparatively slow. What is that? There is a physical something that travels over the actual nerve. There is a measurable electrical potential in here that stops when you die. I think we're nibbling around the edges of the concept of human mind. Come back to this. Mind has three functions. Or is functionally different on three levels. In the super universes, mind mediates the divergence between spirit and matter. And you have your great statement about power personality unification. In the evolutionary universes of time and space, energy matter is dominant, save in personality, where spirit, through the mediation of mind, is striving for the mastery. Or to disassemble that sentence, energy matter was here first. Example, Nebadon, the nebula, Andromeda, the nebula, got started over 500 billion years before Michael arrived out here to whip it into a local universe. Matter energy was here first. Now, how can order be brought out of chaos? Mind can dominate matter. Example, the human race is slowly whipping nature on this planet. A pipeline is like an artery. A telegraph wire is like a nerve. We're slowly remaking this planet in man's image. Someday we'll control weather, I believe. How can spirit dominate matter? Not directly. Spirit doesn't touch matter at any point. Only mind touches matter. Why is it that only in personality can spirit strive for the mastery? Because only in personality do you have the power of choice, which can subject matter-dominating mind to spirit leading. Why should it do this? Because otherwise, mind can't win the victory. Can we prove this? Yes. Look at the world today. Man's mind has unlocked too damn many of the secrets of nature. This mind is not spirit dominated, and we are afraid. We have unleashed more physical power than we have developed the spiritual, ethical, and moral principles to control effectively. And I do read things about shelters and fallouts and other tokens of apprehension, fear. Now that's the function of mind in time and space, to mediate the divergence between energy, material energy, and spirit. How does mind function on paradise? On paradise, there is no such divergence. On paradise, you take your ammeter, voltmeter, and you plug it into the central aisle, and you get a reading. Now, no disrespect meant, but if you could plug it into the eternal sun, the same instrument would give you the same type of reading. And so with the Universal Father. The spirit manifestation of the eternal sun and the physical energy manifestation of the eternal isle are exactly the same. The only difference between the two is one which you intellectually supply. Manota comes from paradise, and paradise spirit comes from the sun. But your ammeter voltmeter can't distinguish in its reading. So mind on paradise has no divergence to mediate, does it? It has a different function. Infinite nature of God the Father, there could not possibly exist duality of reality, such as physical and spiritual. But the instant we look aside from the infinite levels and absolute reality of the personal values of the Paradise Father, we observe the existence of these two realities and recognize that they are fully responsive to His personal presence. In Him, all things consist. The moment you depart from the unqualified concept of the infinite personality of the Paradise Father, you must postulate mind as the inevitable technique of unifying the ever-widening divergence of these dual universe manifestations of the original monothetic oneness, creator personality, the first source and center. Mind on Paradise is a third reality, but it does not function as mind functions in time and space. What is mind like in Havana? It's a good thing I did my homework. On Paradise, mind is absolute. In Havana, absonite. In Arvantan, finite. Havana mind is sub-absolute, but super-evolutionary, being existential, experiential. It is nearer the absonite than any other concept revealed to you. So Havana mind is really not absonite, is it? But they're picking the word that comes the closest. And then they warn us, please don't apply this label without some reservations. It's existential, experiential mind. In Havana, you don't have the problem you have on Paradise. The material worlds of Havana are put together with material energy systems which are called triata, which means not like what we know out here, but material energy. Belongs to the same family. Spirit in Havana is completely distinguishable from Havana triada. I don't think the same ammeter, voltmeter will register the same on spirit in Havana as it will on triada in Havana. You got to have two different kinds of ammeters, voltmeters, to get readings. But there's no conflict. There is a divergence, but in Havana, no disharmony between matter and spirit. Havana being characterized by flawless perfection. There are no storms in Havana. On planet 48 in the outermost circuits of Havana, if you get on a TWA jet at St. Louis and plan to fly to Oklahoma City, you get there every time. Oklahoma City Airport is never fogged out on that planet, assuming they have such names and such communities up there and such modes of transportation. This is not altogether a reliable prediction to make down here on Earth. We have conflicts here. The mediating function of mind, which we observe, is partly observable in Havana, but non-observable on Paradise. We can see out here, we can feel out here, that mind intervenes between the values of spirit and the facts of matter. Do you all feel that? If you want to produce a material result, would you pray, or would you set up a material cause? I think setting up the material cause is the more reliable, more dependable of the two possible approaches. If you want to produce a spiritual result, would you experiment in the laboratory, or would you pray? I think prayer would be a much better approach to that objective. since we have mind, we can study matter. And if we don't take it too far, it's pretty comprehensible. But as we pursue matter to its ultimate, matter itself becomes a little hard to explain, doesn't it? For example, I'm instructed that it's possible to determine either the position or the velocity of an electron, but you cannot determine both concerning the same electron at the same time. Now, I accept that scientific statement with some faith because I've read it more than once, but I really don't understand why you can't any more than I fully understand the Trinity. But most observers of the small particles of matter, they all agree you can't do this. But why can't you? Why can't you find out where it is at the same time that you find out how fast it's moving? There's a scientific problem. It's a little hard to explain, isn't it? Mind can observe matter, but mind can hardly observe spirit directly. Mind, in a sense, is a higher order of reality than matter. And I visualize spirit as being a higher order of reality than mind, and personality as being the highest order of reality. Is matter conscious, unless you add mind? Even living matter? Where could we find such living matter? In the laboratories of the life carriers. They activate mindless protoplasm for experimental purposes, working out their formulae for life implantation. That living protoplasm is not conscious. You have to add mind to living matter to produce consciousness. Could you have such a condition where you could have a conscious material being who had no personality, no spirit endowment? I think a friend Lang could be a pretty good illustration. This is a living barometer that intelligently measures energy presences and pressures. This is a piece of living machinery. No spirit endowment, absolutely no choice, just an intelligent barometer. I think your friend Lank is physical. Probably not as we would understand the word physical. But I know that friend Lank is not spiritual. This is a material minded living being. But you don't have to add mind to spirit, do you? Spirit has an innate mindedness, with or without the being encircuited in a mind circuit. But is spirit personal? No. Not unless it is endowed with personality by God. That's the limitation of spirit. As I think of the order of precedence, I put matter at the bottom, then mind, then spirit, then personality. But personality has its limitations. It can never be manifested all by itself, can it? It must always have a living vehicle to ride. That could be a spirit being. That could be a mind spirit being. That could be a material mind being. Or a material mind spirit being. But never a mind being. Always you find a limitation here in each one of these qualities. They need something else. Even the highest order of reality needs some kind of energy. Spirit energy, mind energy, spirit energy, spirit mind energy, material mind energy, or material spirit mind energy in order to be a living personality. Question.
Page 142. Mortal man has a spirit system.
Yeah.
The mind is a personal energy system existing around a divine spirit nucleus and functioning in a material environment. Thus, a living relationship of personal mind and spirit constitutes the universal potential of eternal personality. Now we're getting free of these realities.
Sure you are. Man is a mind, matter, spirit, personal creature.
Real trouble, life and disappointment, serious disease, and taking death can come only after self-concept presumes fully to displace the governing power of the central spirit nucleus, thereby disrupting this cosmic scheme of personality identity. Now, prior to this, I don't know, page 135, it says the human personality is not merely a concomitant of time and space events. The human personality also acts as the cosmic cause of such events.
Sure, you play poker within the limitations of the situation. Our problem in visualizing...
This is a use of mind.
Yeah. Mind is a tool that you have. The... Consider mind as a tool. Human personalities live, are self-conscious, make decisions, choose God or forsake Him, eternalize or destroy themselves. Material evolution has provided you a life machine, your body. The Father Himself has endowed you with the purest spirit reality known in the universe. Your thought adjuster. But into your hands, subject to your own decisions, has been given mind. And it is by mind that you live or die. It is within this mind and with this mind that you make those moral decisions which enable you to achieve adjuster likeness, and that is God likeness. 12:16. Mortal mind is a temporary intellect system loaned to human beings for your use during a material lifetime. And as they use this mind, they are either accepting or rejecting the potential of eternal existence. Mind is about all that you have of universe reality that is subject to your will. And the soul, the Marantia self, will faithfully portray the harvest of the temporal decisions which the mortal self is making. Human consciousness rests gently upon the electrochemical mechanism below and delicately touches the spirit Marantia energy system above, the soul. Of neither of these two systems is the human being ever completely conscious in his mortal life. Therefore must he work in mind, of which he is conscious. And it is not so much what mind comprehends as what mind desires to comprehend that ensures survival. It is not so much what mind is like as what mind is striving to be like that constitutes spirit identification. It is not so much that man is conscious of God as that man yearns for God that results in universe ascension. What you are today is not so important as what you are becoming day by day and in eternity. Mind is the cosmic instrument on which the human will can play the discords of destruction, or upon which the same human will can bring forth the exquisite melodies of God identification and consequent eternal survival. The adjuster bestowed upon man is, in the last analysis, impervious to evil and incapable of sin. But mortal mind can actually be twisted, distorted, and rendered evil and ugly by the sinful machinations of a perverse and self-seeking human will. Likewise, can this mind be made noble, beautiful, true and good, actually great, in accordance with the spirit-illuminated will of a God-knowing human being. Evolutionary mind is only fully stable and dependable when manifesting itself upon the two extremes of cosmic intellectuality, the wholly mechanized and the entirely spiritualized. Between the intellectual extremes of pure mechanical control, an animal, and true spirit nature, there intervenes that enormous group of evolving and ascending minds whose stability and tranquility are dependent upon personality choice and spirit identification. But man does not passively, slavishly surrender his will to the adjuster. Rather, does he actively, positively, and cooperatively choose to follow the adjuster's leading, when and as such leading consciously differs from the desires and impulses of the natural mortal mind. The adjusters manipulate, but they never dominate man's mind against his will. To the adjusters, the human will is supreme, and they so regard and respect it, while they strive to achieve the spiritual goals of thought adjustment and character transformation. In
all set. Mind is your ship.
No, but the adjuster is your pilot. The human will is captain. I like that relationship. Ship, captain, and pilot. The master of the mortal vessel should have the wisdom to trust the divine pilot to guide the ascending soul into the Marantia harbors of eternal survival. Only by selfishness, slothfulness, and sinfulness can the will of man reject the guidance of such a loving pilot and eventually wreck the mortal career upon the evil shoals of rejected mercy and upon the rocks of embraced sin. With your consent, this faithful pilot will safely carry you across the barriers of time and the handicaps of space. This faithful pilot will safely carry you across the barriers of time and the handicaps of space to the very source of the divine mind and on beyond, even to the paradise father of adjustment. Practically speaking, that's mind. This is what you work with. These are your tools. We can't work spiritually. We're not spiritual by nature, but we are intellectual by nature. You have spiritual feelings, and you have physical sensations. But where do you actually live? About 2 inches behind here, don't you? About 2 inches behind here, don't you? Feel yourself. Where are you? It's somewhere in the skull, right? How much do you know about your body? Not too much. You're not too conscious of digestion, only indigestion.
That's true.
Do you know what's going on in your automatic nervous system? No. You get certain pain sensations, certain comfortable, uncomfortable sensations, sensations of fatigue. Are you smart enough to run your body? You're darn right you aren't. The thing weren't done automatically for you in the medulla and other places, you wouldn't operate. Do you tell your heart to beat? Do you tell yourself to breathe, except under unusual circumstances? No, it's all done for you. We don't know much about this body. If we did, we wouldn't have physiology, the medical profession, or anything else. We'd understand our body and repair it. You don't know much about your soul or spiritual things, but you live in mind. And that, to me, is, these are the tools we've been given to work with. This is about all we have of cosmic reality that has really been subjected to the control of our will. How we can extend our mind through tools, through science, we can extend our dominance over the physical world. Through prayer, through worship, through acts that are good, we can extend, I guess I want to say inward, closer to the adjuster. This is the inward extension of man, which should counterbalance the outward extension of man. And if we keep these two in balance, we're safe. If we get them out of balance, we're in trouble. You see, again, they're talking about mind is safe only when it's in bondage to matter or has affiliated with spirit. And mind. This is 1301, bottom of the page. The spirit liberates, and the mechanism limits the function of will. Imperfect choice, uncontrolled by mechanism, unidentified with spirit, is dangerous and unstable. Mechanical dominance ensures stability at the expense of progress. Spirit alliance liberates choice from the physical level and at the same time assures the divine stability produced by augmented universe insight and increased cosmic comprehension. The great danger that besets the creature, and this is right where man is today, the great danger that besets the creature is that in achieving liberation from the fetters of the life mechanism, he will fail to compensate this loss of stability by effecting a harmonious working liaison with spirit. Creature choice, when relatively liberated from mechanical stability, may attempt further self-liberation independent of greater spirit identification. When man is in bondage to nature, he has no problem. Spends all his time trying to eke out a living, fill his belly. He's on the beam. The whole principle of biologic evolution makes it impossible for primitive man to appear on the inhabited world with any large endowment of self-restraint. Therefore, does the same creative design which purposed evolution likewise provide those external restraints of time and space, hunger and fear, which effectively circumscribe the sub-spiritual choice range of such uncultured creatures. As man's mind successfully overrides increasingly difficult barriers, this same creative design is also provided for the slow accumulation of the racial heritage of painfully garnered experiential wisdom. In other words, for the maintenance of a balance between the diminishing external restraints and the augmenting internal restraints, morals, ethics. The slowness of evolution, of human cultural progress, testifies to the effectiveness of that brake, material inertia, which so efficiently operates to retard dangerous velocities of progress. Thus does time itself cushion and distribute the otherwise lethal results of premature escape from the next encompassing barriers to human action. For when culture advances over fast, when material achievement outruns the evolution of worship wisdom, then does civilization contain within itself the seeds of retrogression. Blow ourselves up. And unless buttressed by the swift augmentation of experiential wisdom, such human societies will recede from high but premature levels of attainment, and the dark ages of the interregnum of wisdom will bear witness to the inexorable restoration of the imbalance between self-liberty and self-control. The iniquity of Caligastia was the bypassing of the time governor of progress, of progressive human liberation, the gratuitous destruction of restraining barriers, barriers which the mortal minds of those times had not experientially overridden. That mind, which can effect a partial abridgment of time and space, by this very act proves itself possessed of the seeds of wisdom which can effectively serve in lieu of the transcended barrier of restraint. Think how long it was that the oak barrier determined human velocity. Man didn't move faster than a horse. That's the oak barrier. Now we've cracked the sound barrier.
Excuse me, folks.
Take off.
I'll kill you. I said, too. I never leave without taking two.
George, you came. You won. I thought you got the second chance.
Well, that's good. I sure did.
Yes, they sure did. Well,
they what?
They
what?
They came.
That's because
they've
been
playing.
Who did?
Oh, the whole gang.
Five. You included me when you said that.
Well, you were in the gang.
I didn't. I could have skipped one, but...
Lucifer similarly sought to disrupt the time governor operating in restraint of the premature attainment of certain liberties in the local system. A local system settled in light and life has experientially achieved those viewpoints and insights which make feasible the operation of many techniques that would be disruptive and destructive in the pre-settled eras of that very realm. As man shakes off the shackles of fear, as he bridges continents and oceans with his machines, generations and centuries with his records, he must substitute for each transcended restraint a new and voluntarily assumed restraint in accordance with the moral dictates of expanding human wisdom. These self-imposed restraints are at once the most powerful and the most tenuous of all the factors of human civilization, concepts of justice, and ideals of brotherhood. Man even qualifies himself for the restraining garments of mercy when he dares to love his fellow men, while he achieves the beginnings of spiritual brotherhood when he elects to mete out to them that treatment which he himself would be accorded, even that treatment which he conceives God would accord them. An automatic universe reaction is stable and in some form continuing in the cosmos. A personality who knows God and desires to do his will, who has spirit insight, is divinely stable and eternally existent. Man's great universe adventure consists in the transit of his mortal mind from the stability of mechanical statics to the divinity of spiritual dynamics. And he achieves this transformation by the force and constancy of his own personality decisions in each of life's situations, declaring, "It is my will that your will be done."
In other words, in short, you're telling us in order to maintain stability and practicability, we must be equally balanced scientifically and spiritually.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. The minute we start to crack it,
we get lost sight.
In the beginning, we're safe.
Mm-hmm.
And Don found I had very little time to get into mischief. They had to sweat it out. Sontag came along and the other kids came along. They were busy. They served a harsh taskmaster of an unfriendly world. They got hungry. Now, we've got time for leisure. And we can go to hell in a handbasket if we want to. Sure. The minute we start cracking the material restraints of mind, we've got to buy some spiritual restraints. When a people has no real concept of justice, how can you suddenly give them liberty without invoking tragedy? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. How can you ask people to cast the ballot who have no education? This experiment in a republic, and remember that to the founding fathers of this country, the word democracy was a dirty word. Don't ever forget that. This experiment in self-government worked, because good heavens, we rested upon all the evolution of constitutional government in England. And this was our springboard. And without that background, no group of men could have sat down in Philadelphia and have ever written a constitution such as we have. It's certainly not perfect, but it's lasted a long time. It's worked rather well.
Might have had some help.
Oh, I'll lay odds they did. All the odds they did, this I believe. There's Seraphim of Nation Life here. And this was a great new experiment in Nation Life. And don't you think that the planetary Seraphim of Nation Life weren't concerned in that Philadelphia operation?
Individual.
Sure. That's right. Oh, they picked men that wanted to do this, but I'll bet dollars to donuts, many may, they helped them. They helped them. It's the first time in the history of this world that government was clearly articulated into its three branches. And they tell us that's the way they run the universe. They have three branches. What else you want to talk about mind? Mind's what we have to work with. It's about all we have. It's our toolkit. It's up to us to build with it. We should build in two directions. We ought to reach out. I think that mind inherently wants to dominate matter. You know, you look at something that's a repetitive act, and it's just, why did the Universal Father build paradise? Well, in human terms, if we want to anthropomorphize God a little bit, and of course we have to think about it, he did it because he says, why should I be concerned with running a material universe? I'll build a machine to do this. And to me, paradise is the absolute machine which God built for the same reason that we build machines, to perform repetitive acts, which are really unworthy of human beings. Why have an elevator operator if you can have push buttons? You know, there was these restraints. There's an awfully good book. If you want to get it for your library, it would be worth buying. You'll have trouble getting it. It's called The Principles of Power. It was written back in the 30s by an Italian historian called Guillermo Ferraro, William Ferrara in English. I met his nephew, who's a physician in Ohio now. And Guillermo Ferraro was kicked out of Italy by Mussolini. And he was writing in Switzerland. Have you read it?
I've read the
Mm-hmm. He offers several interesting concepts of government. But he points out that the thing that makes a representative government work is something stronger than steel and more tenuous than cloud. It's trust.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of fear. So that no matter which side wins, you don't take to the hill with your friends and 10,000 rifles and 100,000 rounds of ammunition and build for the revolution. You might have some reprisals if you're a paving contractor and your party loses, but they're economic, they're not personal. Your life isn't in jeopardy, your property isn't in jeopardy. But how did this trust evolve? Do you suppose that credit cards would work in Malaya? I'm not so sure they would. They work pretty well over here. We trust each other. Our whole system of credit is based on the fact we've learned to trust. Our whole government's based
our
on
whole
trust.
Our whole system of credit is based on greed.
Yes.
Yes.
Well,
I see
your idea.
But the fact that people are willing to take your signature,
mm-hmm.
By and large, we've learned to be honest, Wilma.
In the last few years, it has gotten back to the point of
of the seller. Well, I didn't mean that so much as I meant the fact that you can sign your name for something, like a check. Yeah, I'm not talking about the installment plan stuff. Pardon me for the same word applies.
You can buy a cemetery lot now,
On time?
Yeah. Practically no end.
No
end. That isn't greedy, Roma.
Is that sort of the layaway plan?
And he trusts you'll show up, is it?
You know,
you give green stamp. Don't put others in
about
it. I think y'all made a serious mistake when you quit meeting out there. Because the environment would be very stimulating, more as opposed to some of these problems.
I always had an extra bag.
Sure.
Very appropriate.
Time to get with it was right now, because if you looked out the window, you could see your mortal end. There was Bill going by, leaving somebody else.
You folks remember that cartoon in the New Yorker? Two fellows with the long beards and the sheets, at the corner of something and something in Manhattan. One fellow had a sign, flee, to the city of refuge, the other side, beware of the wrath to come. And the caption below says, you know that people aren't laughing like they used to.
I read a clip that I said that the grieving that goes on after a funeral is not necessarily because of the departed one, it's just that we realize that that is who we are in too. That's why you grieve.
Might you hear some things you wanted to ask Bill?
I did. I forgot them now. I can't control the conversation.
I think our whole problem is how do we use mind? How do we? The human maturation is nothing more than an escape from time. Human beings are born in bondage to time. I've gotten reacquainted with a baby. Our next door neighbors have a heck of a nice one. Well, they both look like they should have good genes, and it looks like a nice combination. This young'un is about 19 months old and has the run of about 5 apartments on our floor. And I'm sure she feels that she has a lot of parents. As you watch her span of attention, it doesn't last too long, does it? Y'all remember, kids. My memory is being refreshed. This child is living intensely in the present. If you take something away from her, her life has come to an end. And she's apt to demonstrate it vocally. Like losing one's whole family today, you know. Of course, she doesn't cry very long either. As we mature, we should escape from that terrible bondage to the present mood, the present moment. And we begin to defer present pleasure for more durable pleasure, don't we? Aren't we moving out of time a little bit as we strike off the shackles of the fetters of the present and we think back and experience and project forward and consider the worth of the goal that we strive for? We make a moral choice. And basically, we're de-animalizing ourselves, aren't we? As we detemporalize ourselves. A wise man is much less in bondage to time than a child because he considers consequences and worth. He examines these goals. Rodin, in his talk with Nathaniel and Thomas, commented on the willingness to give up present pleasure for a worthier future goal. The whole principle of saving is based on this, isn't it? Shall we get a washing machine now, or shall we put it in the bank? And your objection to credit is an intensification of the present. I agree with you. I think it's quite pernicious. But don't tell a retail merchant that. Shall I look at TV or get my homework done? The burning question of the teenager. Well, of course, it depends a great deal on how tough the homework is and how good the programs are.
They suffer too nowadays because of this much work material,
so they don't have time for anything. Yeah. I think mind is a fascinating subject. Someday we ought to make a write-up on it, don't you think? I haven't got this one done yet. If I ever get to write a study of reality, mind is a subject to study.
It's got to be.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's a fascinating one. They start maybe with 192. It's got the 191.
Sure.
All
that's right.
Of our sure. Presence.
That's all.
Have you folks read Psychology of the Promethean Will? I think that's one of the great books I think that's been written in the 20th century. And as I think of what Sheldon calls the dying back of the forebrain, it's such a tragic thing. The people that don't pick up their option to grow. I've sometimes tried to put it this way, that growth is inescapable until about age 25. We certainly grow until about 20, and it would take 5 years for the momentum to die out. But so many people stop growing at 25. It's optional beyond that, and they don't take their option.
They get on the treadmill.
Yes. I so many times think of 14th Street in New York. I had a dinner date with two gals, and they exercised their prerogative of being a little late, and there's two entrances to Luchow's, grand old German restaurant there. And I stood in between the two entrances, because, you know, you could just be sure and miss them at one entrance or the other. And I looked at all those people at 5:30. It's one of the broad east-west streets in Manhattan. And they kept moving by. And I didn't see anybody that looked animated. Their eyes looked a bit glassy. It was the end of the day. They were moving towards the subway, walking kind of mechanically, bemused. And I thought, are these people alive? Are they just in a treadmill? I was talking to a businessman, and we were out on the Michigan Avenue Bridge in Chicago, and he was yakking away, and it was a spring day. And I said, do you ever stop and look at the beauty of this city? He said, what do you mean? Well, I said, come on over here. Let's lean up against this balustrade. And we looked up at the Tribune building and the old Medina building, the Sheraton Hotel, towering up against an unbelievably blue sky. I said, look at those colors. I said, they're here. If you'll stop and look at them. I said, isn't that a pretty girl walking? There's so much in life, I think, that we don't even see anymore. We forget to look for it. It's there. Doesn't it say somewhere in here that only a poet can discover poetry in the commonplace prose of humdrum existence? Isn't that a quote from the book somewhere? In the Morocco Life?
The fact of the exhilaration that makes you need a sense of humor.
That we live nowadays.
The
exhilaration of things we do nowadays. True. But it's here all around us. Sure. It's here. We'll stop and look for it. I don't even pass up Mary Catherine down at the end of the table. See, I'm watching her out of the corner of my eye. You can drink in beauty anyway. How about that for you? What else you want to talk about? You threatened me with a trinity.
That's
gentlemen, I'm afraid that I'm going to have to go too. My wife's been missing at home. She wants to go to the ghost store. And then there was one of the conditions for her to be able to do that.
Did that have her go there?
Yeah, I had a baby sit while she was going to the ghost store. Still, I thoroughly enjoy it. I'm looking forward to the next
time. Nice meeting you, Mike. And always take anything I say with a grain of salt. My ignorance is just better unified than yours.
I think that statement will stick with you. I'll be trying to unify my ignorance.
Get a pencil and a page to ask.
No shortcuts,
one bad enough, I believe.
Well,
I'll just
there
for
mine.
Okay. What do you want to talk about?
I want you to reread that perpendicular gravity because of the dimensions of paradise. Has something to do with the differential dimensions of paradise and gravity operates perpendicular to the mass.
What?
That very nice paragraph there in section 8.
The illustration is crude, but nonetheless helpful. It also explains why gravity always acts preferentially in the plane, perpendicular to the mass, a phenomenon indicative of the differential dimensions of paradise and the surrounding creation. Well, perpendicular... What does perpendicular mean? At right angles to a surface, right? When you stand up here on Earth, do you stand at a 45 degree angle? Or do you stand at a 90 degree angle in relation to the surface you're standing on?
At one point on this globe, you're at 90 degrees.
Well, where you are, I mean. Now, if gravity did not act perpendicularly, then I would stand at a slant, or this way, or that way. But the fact that it's easy to stand straight up tells me gravity is pulling me directly toward the center of the Earth, isn't it? And that's perpendicularly...
Well, that's linear gravity. That's in paradise gravity.
Fine, but it doesn't qualify it here. It just says gravity without specifying. Now, let's consider... I want to make my application to linear gravity first.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yes,
are we clear?
Wait a minute.
Are we clear?
Yes.
Well, no, wait a minute. Where's the mass?
The mass of the Earth.
In this first illustration.
Yes, we're talking about linear gravity. And we're observing the fact that we stand straight up and not at any angle. Mm-hmm. Unless we have a slip disk, in which event you stand at a certain angle. But that's because the pain makes you resist it.
Standing on board a ship, talking.
Yeah. Now, a plumb line hangs straight up and down. Mm-hmm. That's a better illustration. Mm-hmm. And that is true regardless of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the case of paradise, I think you have more gravity horizontally than you have vertically.
No, you do. There's nothing. There's no gravity being exerted in the top part of the hourglass right
now. Nothing to pull off. Nothing to pull off.
That's obvious. It's horizontal.
Right. But the function of paradise gravity moves out like this and not like this. And it has something to do, not everything to do, but something to do with the configuration of the universes. It tends to flatten them. in the image of paradise. Yeah. Which is a modification of the shape of paradise and the whirl of motion in space.
That's the shape of galaxy.
Yeah.
They're making light. Approaching it.
Mm-hmm.
A flat motion.
You've got in time and space, well, Havona was laid out that way, but in time and space, the lenticular shape of a galaxy, I think, is a compromise between the flattening effect of paradise gravity and the swirling effect of the compromise of linear gravity and motion. I hope I'm right. It would take an astrophysicist to really analyze this statement. I gather that what this statement means is that the operation of paradise gravity, circular gravity in time and space, has a flattening effect on what would otherwise be globular in time and space. If it weren't for paradise gravity, I think the galaxies would be much more globular as a planet is. But they aren't. The individual components of a galaxy are globular, but the galaxy itself reflects paradise gravity as well as linear gravity. Winds up as lenticular. Also, I think it has something to do with the fact that things swing in ellipses and not in circles. Now, look, Bert, when they went from the Ptolemaic concept of the solar system to the Copernican concept, Copernicus was in hot water. Because Copernicus thought in circles. It's logical. I mean, knowing about circles, you would figure things would swing around the sun in circles, wouldn't they? And it was Copernicus's trouble in explaining why it wasn't a circle that cast grave doubts upon the whole Copernican system. And I think it wasn't until, was it Tycho followed somebody or other, Kepler, that they worked it out. It wasn't a circle, it was an ellipse. Man's logic never visualized an ellipse. Man's logic said a circle. Now, I think this shape of paradise and the action of paradise gravity has something to do with the fact that things work in ellipses and not in circles. Of course, you've got the whole structure of space there, too. The layout of space is elliptical and not circular. It's only roughly circular. It's actually elliptical. And of course, if paradise were not this shape, you wouldn't have any direction, would you?
No, and I like that absolute north.
Yeah.
Absolute north. That's,
you'd have an up down, but if paradise were circular, you'd have no way of knowing which way was north. But since paradise is elliptical, and since the energy outflow at one end is greater than the other end, you could define north as that end of the ellipse which has the greatest energy outflow.
I asked
Simon
a question
the other night,
and he couldn't answer.
I told you the same thing, and you didn't believe.
You get absolute direction.
He didn't bet those that
work. I'm not smart as Bill is, and I said that they know it because more energy comes out up at the north. And said, well, how do you know that more energy comes out?
They say
so.
How you know it's north?
By definition.
Now, see, I wasn't smart enough to say by definition.
Many may look. When you look at a storage battery, one side is positive, the other side's negative. That's an arbitrary designation.
You mean they really are?
You could switch them, and if you switched them in the beginning, it would make sense, just as much as in accounting. You could switch the functions of debit and credit, but the minute you define a debit as something which increases cash and decreases liability, then you define a credit as having the opposite function in the field of accounting.
By definition,
you said that way. You might have heard something.
You could just as well say that that's the south end of paradise.
Mm-hmm.
In which event, you
know.
Still have absolute direction.
That's
how do you define it?
You know.
I had a long talk with relativity of, concerning relativity of concepts in here with my friend Sandy. These papers oversimplify the cosmos. They present it in Newtonian terms. Probably because Einsteinian concepts are not valid and are pretty incomprehensible. And there's some kind of reconciliation going to have to be worked out between astronomical findings and the concepts presented in the papers. These concepts are only relatively true. The physical dimensions of the universe.
Well, they tell us over and over that our minds can't understand.
Well, I tell you what, someday Sandy will write this up, but when you listen to his presentation of a four-dimensional toroid as a probable intellectual bridge between this and the astronomers, you're going to be glad you've got this. This is hard enough to understand. I don't follow him in his toroidal concept because it's mathematical. You can't describe it in English exactly. Does that make sense, Bert? Perpendicular to the man?
Well, that makes sense, but I don't, it just doesn't, I mean, everything you said makes sense.
To me, it means
I just
that
don't,
circular gravity has a flattening impact on the tendency to form spheres in time and space. If it weren't for let's say that there were no paradise gravity, I think the galaxies would be globular in structure, and the orbits of the planets would be circular and not elliptical. God knows I can't prove that, but I suggest
it also explains why gravity always acts preferentially in the plane perpendicular to the mass, a phenomenon indicative of the differential dimensions of paradise and surrounding creation.
Why is it that the galaxy, a galaxy, crudely duplicates the shape of paradise?
Say it again.
Why is it that a galaxy crudely duplicates the shape of paradise? Its horizontal dimensions are greater than its vertical dimensions, and undoubtedly it's elliptical.
And its greatest going power is at right angles to its widest mass.
Yeah.
Bert, if you use the word mass and put it in
big.
No. If you're talking about linear, it's our planet.
Yeah.
You put the word mass in conjunction with the type of gravity you're thinking about.
Paradise.
You shift that word mass in I've tried to hook it on the one or the other. You've got to shift it.
That's right.
They're two different ones.
Two different masses.
Mm-hmm.
I think their statement refers to gravity in general.
It's just statements, it's
clear.
Well, it's as ambiguous as can be, but boy, you've
thrown
a lot of light on it.
I got a feeling too, Clyde, it might even apply to the binding force of the atom.
Well,